Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to the 300th edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, John Cross of the Daily Mirror, and Seb Stafford-Bloor from Tifo Football. New year, same old dilemma. Frank Lampard is under enormous pressure at Chelsea. Has he reached the point of no return? Logically, he deserves time and respect. But patience isn't exactly woven into Chelsea's DNA. Lampard's status as a club legend offers scant protection. Now, John, you've been with us on the pod from day one. You were at the bridge on Sunday. Give us a sense of the mood, and can you actually see the manager surviving?
I would say any other club, and perhaps in any other season, and I do still think we should look at this upon as an unprecedented, unique season for all the challenges and difficulties, then I would really fear for Frank Lampard right now. And then also, I guess, you know, you'd have a full Stamford Bridge and the Chelsea fans are definitely beginning to question and beginning to turn. I don't think they've completely turned, don't get me wrong. But yeah, I do think the pressure is on Frank Lampard. I personally think that's harsh and that's wrong. I think he's been in the job. Now he's into his second season. We're not even at the halfway point for his second season. In his first season, they reach top four. They get into the cup final. The start of his second season, they spend £200 million on players. And that pushes up expectation levels, which, let's be honest, it was unrealistic to expect anything else than sky-high expectation levels at Stamford Bridge. That's how they work under Roman Abramovich, and they've been incredibly successful with it. But I do think it's harsh right now for Frank Lampard to be feeling that sort of heat. Do I think he's in immediate danger? I don't personally. I think the early warning signs are there. But I think that basically we'll be given a little bit more time. I think he should be given a bit more time. I think that basically, bearing in mind earlier in the season, he's been on a 16-game unbeaten run. I think they could have had an opportunity to perhaps go top and then make it sort of pull away clear. And then they were lost at Wolves. And I think it's four defeats in six games or one win in six. Pick your worst stat, whichever you prefer. But a month or so ago, I was on a press conference where he's being asked about what a good job he was doing. What about a new contract for him? So I just think that things turn around so, so quickly. I think the worry is defensively, again, that they look poor. I think there's a lack of cohesion there. Some of the big signings are really underperforming for him. I think we've seen only brilliant bits of Ziyech. I think Werner looks either tired, short of confidence, or a real lack of form, which is a major, major worry. Kai Havertz, I still don't know quite where he fits in this Chelsea system. And those are sort of the issues, I think, that basically are as concerning, perhaps, as the results. Is he making the best of the big name signings, but I really genuinely believe that he should be given time.
Yeah, I suppose, Seb, it boils down to what type of club Chelsea want to be, doesn't it? You know, if they bring in a big name after sacking Lampard, and, you know, already we've got Allegri being mentioned, Thomas Tuchel, Brendan Rodgers even Pochettino, you know, did he jump a week too soon to go to PSG? We've got all that speculation around, which is probably inevitable given the febrile nature of the modern game. But if they do bring in another big name or supposed big name, won't that signal another era of ignoring the academy and a complete 360?
Yeah, I think it probably would, Mike. I think the difficulty, especially in modern football, is that increasingly supporters want to pray at the altar of an ideologue. They want someone to believe in. They want someone with a track record. And that kind of mentality doesn't preclude a manager from picking youth players, but it's not the era of patience. And you, with a youth player, with an academy graduate, you have to be allowed, you know, 6 month cycles. Player has to, you know, be in good form, has to slump, much like Mason Mount did last season. I think one of the problems for Lampard now is that the club have acquired what is a very, very expensive German core, and some of the best managers in Europe who are available right now are also German. And so that's a threat to him. If you think, I mean, they're not probably going to make a run at Julian Nagelsmann in the middle of a season, but, you know, he would probably be available within about 6 months' time. Thomas Tuchel obviously is a free agent. There are others knocking about. And part of the problem for Lampard is an underperforming set of German internationals who are extremely talented. And that's very difficult. And I think that if you start a new era as a club, do supporters care that much anymore? I mean, they should. I mean, but it feels almost like if you give them something else to believe in, which you would if you installed a Tuchel with his philosophy, with his track record at Dortmund and to a lesser extent Paris Saint-Germain, all of a sudden there's this kind of textured CV that people can grasp, which Lampard doesn't have. So I don't think it's that much of an obstacle.
So John, though, isn't it? It's not as simple, is it, as throwing more money at a problem, though probably Rice would help them. And it also points up the influence of a manager like Frank Lampard in the whole recruitment process. Do you think he had any say, real say, in the sort of kids in a sweet shop approach that they had this summer?
Well, I mean, if we look at Declan Rice as a target, then I think that's definitely a Frank Lampard target. So I think he's in the conversation. If you remember sort of when Timo Werner arrived, there was a lot of talk about, you know, Frank Lampard being heavily involved in luring him to Stamford Bridge. And we shouldn't overlook the fact that Werner started well. But I just think, to me, Werner, I think when I've seen him at his best for Leipzig, it was a combination of playing down the middle and then wide. And there seems to be this debate whether sort of they're wasting Werner wide. He's not very happy there, and that's why we're not seeing the best out of him. Well, he did do both roles. And he did, I thought when Chelsea signed him, they were signing a brilliant striker and forward because he could play equally effectively and would be comfortable doing both roles through the middle and also perhaps wide of a three. And we all know that wide of a three doesn't necessarily mean playing on the wing. It just means wide of a front three. You know, it's just a different way. So I just think that he was involved in that process. Yeah. And I think that Chilwell has been a good signing. I mean, he had a really poor game against Sterling, didn't he, to be honest? And Sterling, you know, tore him apart, I think, to be honest. But I think when we talk about Declan Rice, they could do with the Declan Rice. Well, they've got an N'Golo Kante. And N'Golo Kante has, for the last, what, 4 or 5 years, been arguably the best anchor man in the Premier League and one of, if not the best, in Europe. And at the moment, he's just not looking like the same old N'Golo Kante. That was evidenced when Sterling broke free. And frankly, Chelsea were a bit of an indisciplined mess. And Mendy, I think, that was definitely heavily influenced by Lampard and Petr Cech. So I think he's had input there. So it's not exactly done without his say-so, which I guess if he's had input in signings that are not doing so well brings his own pressures. But I just think he just needs time. I mean, Havertz is clearly a phenomenal talent, but aren't we stuck in this age-old English problem which makes us look so antiquated and old-fashioned? We're desperately looking for this kind of pigeonhole to put Havertz in. And I still don't think Chelsea haven't found yet his best position in that system. Because I think they want to play a four. It might end up being a three to get Havertz in. But they certainly haven't got the best out of him yet.
Yeah, well, I suppose we have to also mention that he has struggled with COVID as well, hasn't he? That was one of the games, the City games, where you looked at a certain players and you almost saw them contemplating retirement in front of you, you know, as Azpilicueta with Foden. He couldn't deal with his pace or his movement. Thiago looked rash and out-positioned a lot. that's the issue, isn't it? They've still really not got the optimal defence, have they?
Yeah, and it shows in different ways as well, Mike. Obviously, Thiago Silva was, I wouldn't say embarrassed by Gundogan, but, I mean, was made to look my age, basically, by Gundogan for goal one. I thought Phil Foden was absolutely brilliant. I mean, Azpilicueta did not have a good game, but I thought Foden was exceptional. And I think you could see that by Pep Guardiola's reaction to him when he substituted him. To me, Mike, like that defensive thing, that lack of structure, I think it shows in transition. I mean, some of the sort of the movements from back to front by City were very slick and very watchable, but from a defensive perspective, really hard to justify. Do you remember a couple of weeks ago when we all had our fun with that Demba Ba goal that Man United conceded out in Turkey? I mean, you know, De Bruyne's goal, it's pretty much a carbon copy. And how, I don't care how good a player N'Golo Kante is, and he is in many ways in the past, he's been kind of worth two holding players in one body. You can't allow a player to be in that situation against players like Sterling, Foden, De Bruyne. That's asking for trouble. And so when we talk about defence, we're thinking about like centre halves, you know, position of fullbacks, and that's all a stick with which to beat Lampard. But that transitional stuff, I mean, it's kind of become a buzzword of the modern game. But if you look at how contemporary coaches manage that side of possession and being out of possession, that's really where they earn their supper. And that was alarming yesterday. It was, very hard to defend.
Yeah, if you look at City, John, I think it's 7 unbeaten now. They're obviously gathering momentum. Guardiola, okay, he's had 29 trophies. They speak for themselves. There's almost a sudden motivation now to extend his career. You know, he's talking about evidence that he's become a better manager in what is his fifth season at City. Do you go along with that? And why do you think suddenly he's gone from saying, you know, we've got burnout issues, I'll be out the game by 50, to actually saying, yeah, I'm going to see this job through?
The only thing I can, I mean, blimey, signing a new contract has got to do something with it, isn't it? Yeah. but that's got to be a driving force of it. But I think when managers do talk like that, I think it's got to come from a belief in the players and the players, what they do for him. And I'll be perfectly honest, I thought fairly soon after he'd signed that new contract that I was thinking, what has City done here? Because you won't find a bigger fan of Guardiola than me. I mean, he's in my eyes, he's restructured and rethought out the way that we play in this country. I mean, he's been phenomenal, the influence that he's had on English football. And I was just beginning to wonder, I thought, blimey, I thought one TV commentator summed it up brilliantly. I think it was during the West Ham game, which I think they eventually drew. But you know, had the chances to win. You're almost watching a kind of a Man City tribute act. They look like Man City. They sort of kind of sound like Man City, but don't quite play as well as them, you know. And it felt like that. And I just think that the signing of Ruben Diaz shouldn't be underestimated. I think they signed a no-nonsense proper defender there that suddenly made them look solid and suddenly given John Stones his mojo back, because Stones is playing with a belief and a confidence that he's got a real defender alongside him. And it's interesting, isn't it? Laporte might struggle to get his place back even when he's fully fit. And it just gives them a base, I think, that really, that they were without arguably their first choice two fullbacks, and yet they still have a sort of a structure around their defence. And I just think it's the players that perhaps have given that belief back. And I was the first to say I don't think they did enough in the window, because I don't think they signed a proper player to move on from Aguero, a real successor, I should say, for Aguero. So I still think there's gaps there. But I looked at them yesterday and I really felt that this is a Man City, the best that I've seen them since those back-to-back title wins. They're really in this title race. And I have no doubt if Guardiola is suddenly re-evaluating where his career is and where he's going with Man City, it's because of just how good Man City are right now.
Well, they certainly look rested. Do you give any credence to the conspiracy theories, Seb?
No, I don't, Mike. And you know what, also, I find it quite distasteful that we, given the times we live in and the situations we're all trying to deal with, that at any given opportunity where a football club errs on the side of caution, you've got kind of an army of people suggesting that, you know, cancellations are being, or the fixtures just being manipulated, put it that way. I think also after the last 9 months that we've all had, I think I've had my fill of conspiracy theories. So I think my tolerance is quite low.
Because on that, you know, we are in unique times. John, you were there when Pep was speaking afterwards. In what, to me as an observer, an external observer, you were there, was a really tone-deaf defence of Benjamin Mendy. Does he need to look outside the football bubble here?
Yeah, he absolutely does. I was staggered, frankly. I was really, really surprised. Bearing in mind, you know, not only do I have a huge amount of respect for Guardiola, Guardiola's been personally hit by this pandemic, by this tragedy, losing a close relative. And I was ever so surprised at that, because I think it's indefensible. I mean, it's all well and good to say, oh, it's kind of wasn't a New Year's party, and you know, he's a good guy, and Guardiola offering a defence. But the fundamental fact is that we all know the rules. We all know the crisis facing this country right now. And I'd like to think that everyone listening, and I know for sure that I have, been incredibly careful. And yet here we are with a footballer bringing people in that he's not allowed to do. It's an extravagance that he's not allowed to do. He clearly thinks, like the Spurs players and Lanzini from West Ham before him, thinks he's above all that. Being a couple of Palace captain and Mitrovic from Fulham getting together. Where are they coming from on this? Footballers clearly think they're above the rules. And it really, really annoys me. And, you know, football's been given special dispensation by the government, like elite sport. And they're taking it for granted. And basically, I know that the Premier League are frustrated. The Premier League have written to clubs to urge them to remind the players. I think the FA are looking on thinking, wish we could do something, and they can't really. It's the league that enforce the protocols. And the government must be thinking, well, if they're setting a bad example that makes society think that's acceptable, then maybe we should perhaps think again about football being a special case. And then you get Pep Guardiola, one of the most respected voices in the game, defending the player. I just didn't understand where it was coming from, really. I thought it was an appalling story, and then also an appalling lack of judgment, really, on Guardiola's part. I didn't agree with it at all. I thought it was really surprised me, that from Guardiola, because when he speaks, we listen. And I thought it was a strange statement to make.
Well, it was equally, I think, surprising when, you know, Roy Hodgson excused his captain's behaviour and basically said fans are more concerned about winning matches. You know, I know it's a difficult, almost problem of protocol, but I think it's 7 Premier League players in the last couple of days are alleged to have breached COVID rules. Surely the FA, if they mean anything and if they have any power, which frankly I'm beginning to doubt, surely they should think about banning these players, shouldn't they?
Yeah, I think so, Mike. I think that's right. I think you have to set a precedent and to make example of people. I mean, we are, as you say, we're 9 months into this and this is still happening. In the beginning, when there were a few mixed messages and when people were still adjusting to what life under COVID was like, you could kind of make a defense. You can't now because everyone knows the rules. For me, though, I think the example has to be set earlier in the process. Whether the FA has the authority to impact this situation, I don't know. But certainly when managers talk and when clubs react to how their players have behaved, that is far more impactful on fans, and it sets a stronger statement. So for instance, I agree with Crossy entirely about the Guardiola situation. It was very bizarre to hear him say what he did. Equally, I thought Jose Mourinho was very strong on this. I think it's very effective for someone like Mourinho to, for want of a better expression, to throw a couple of his players under the bus, rightly so. Sergio Reguilón let his club down, let himself down, let his managers and his teammates down. Eric Lamela did the same thing and has quite rightly been sat down for tomorrow's League Cup semi-final. The clubs have to be the one to make the statement because they have the loudest voice of all, particularly the managers. And so when a player does ignore the regulations, when they do behave as if football is a special case and we can do what we want, then the message has to be unequivocal. It's bizarre that football still hasn't got a handle on this. They still don't quite understand how the public react. It's very, very strange. We're nearly a year into it.
Mm. You mentioned the League Cup semi-finals this midweek. John, Manchester United, Manchester City at Old Trafford on Wednesday. How important do you think that game is in the context of the season?
I think that every game is absolutely huge for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer in that. I'm coming from the basis that frankly, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is in crisis or going to win the title within the space of each 90 minutes. And it's just astonishing. I can't think of another club like it. And it's just... And I know it's the League Cup and I know it's the Carabao Cup and it's a different competition. But if City win and thrash them, then the fallout is what does this mean for Solskjaer? Is Solskjaer still the right choice if they miss the boat in Maurizio Pochettino? And that is life for Solskjaer, who by the way, you know, as we speak now ahead of Liverpool, they're basically on level on points with Liverpool. I mean, it's the most bizarre thing because I have to say earlier points in the season, I was looking at United and Solskjaer crashing out the Champions League and they made an awful start, didn't they, really? And we were questioning, is Solskjaer the right man? And frankly, some of the performances haven't been great. They nicked it against Wolves. It wasn't a great game. I thought that the win over Villa was a really big win for Solskjaer. And Villa are a really good side, particularly away from home. So that's a big, big victory for them. But it wasn't completely free-flowing and fluent at times, but albeit a really good win. And then I just think that suddenly it's City and then the focus is back on United again. So I don't think we should ever underestimate it. I also think the other aspect is that Solskjaer has spoken a lot about being a losing semi-finalist and wanting to go one step further and needing to address that and finally delivering a trophy, being the nearly men last season in semi-finals, which they were. And I just think that they do need to address that. And beating City would be a huge lift for United. And that's why I think it's vital for Solskjaer. And I think it's a huge game.
Yeah, well, they are 9 points better off after 16 Premier League games compared to last season. You know, we can debate how that actually is the case. Do you think this is the key month for United, Seb? You know, given that they've got league games at Liverpool and Arsenal, I suppose we should all go on hype alert for the January 17th game at Anfield, shouldn't we?
Yeah, we should, especially this season, Mike, because we've seen that all it takes is like a 3-game run of form and you're either in mid-table or you're second or third. Like really this season we've had Chelsea up there, we've had Spurs up there, we've had Everton who are still up there, Leicester, and then now Man United. I think it's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think you see what you want with Solskjaer. Like if you're someone that thinks he is a little bit overpromoted or is fortunate to be in a situation, then you're going to fixate on the kind of the boom-bust nature of the results, the penalties, the Bruno Fernandes effect, those kind of things. If you're someone who, you know, wants to look in another direction, then you see the different combinations, the slight improvement in defence, the development of individual players, the ability to get a little bit of a tune out of Paul Pogba, things like that. So it's an unwinnable argument. I mean, it's not as if football needed another unwinnable argument that we all drone on about, you know, week after week, but it is that. So if anyone's waiting, I mean, that game at Liverpool is massive, but if anyone's waiting for a kind of a silver bullet, an argument ending game, it's just never going to happen with him. Unless, you know, something ridiculous happens, like he, you know, wins a domestic treble or something. I don't know, but it's a really difficult situation because no matter what happens at Man United, it's just always going to be so much noise. The conversation's never going to end. It's always going to be boom bust. It's always going to be an overreaction in one way or another. And he's kind of caught in that cycle. And actually, one of the ways to look at it is maybe to his credit, he's been a fairly consistent personality. He's never lost his temper, really. He's had a few bristly moments with some questions in the past, but he's never lost his cool. He's never overreacted. Some of the rhetoric became a little bit thick at times, and the kind of the Fergusonisms were a little bit laboured, but he's handled himself pretty well as a person.
Yeah, well, you know, if we're talking about sagas, I suppose Paul Pogba features in quite a few of them. Did you think, John, that he will leave in the summer? And if so, Is that almost a win-win for his agent, Mino Raiola? In other words, he gets a percentage for selling him. He will probably get a percentage for bringing someone like Haaland in. Modern football?
Yeah, it feels like it, doesn't it? Look, I'm a bit of a rare breed in this. I'm a massive Pogba fan. And I actually think that, I mean, there is a massive frustration, even from my part, who loves to watch Paul Pogba, the entertainer. And that it is obvious that basically he's not really fulfilled expectation or potential during his time at Man United. He's in his fifth season now. We're approaching five years. And when you look back upon it, what a superstar signing it was. £89 million. During that time, he's won the World Cup. He's reached incredible levels, and yet he doesn't seem to have replicated that on a regular basis, consistent basis for Man United. And yet I did see on the Villa game on Friday night, a Paul Pogba that was enjoyed being centre of attention. He won the penalty. He did. And I thought it was a penalty. He knew exactly what he was doing, by the way. Could talk about all day long about the kind of the whys and the rights and wrongs of the decision, but he knew what he was doing. And I have to say, I'm in the camp that thought that it was quite clever, because he was teasing Douglas Luiz. He really was. And thinking, right, I need to get something for my team. So you could make a strong case that Paul Pogba's gone and won that game for United, because he thought, well, I've got to go and salvage something here for the team. And he's won that penalty. And sure enough, United have gone on to win the game. And he clearly enjoys being centre of attention. He's a massive superstar. And I think he will go. And I do think that that is the sort of the state of the nation right now. It has to be a business decision for United. And yeah, whoever comes up with Haaland now, whether that's United or whoever, will be signing another future superstar, frankly. But United, if they do it, they'll be thinking, well, we should have just done it first time around. And that'll teach us not to deal with Mino Raiola, which is what they didn't want to do first time around, and which is why they wanted to miss out. So basically, the lesson in here is that if you want the biggest names, if you want the biggest stars, then you have to deal with Mino Raiola. And say what you like, but Mino Raiola is very, very, very good for his players.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm not winning you over, am I?
No. Okay, what about Liverpool, Seb? You know, let's look beyond the relatively poor run they've had, because they're pretty much a feature of the season, aren't they? How do you think they're placed in terms of personnel? Do you think they'll strengthen this month?
Nah, not this month. I don't think it's a particularly good market. I mean, the one exception to that might be France, because of the media pro situation there and because of the turmoil French clubs are suffering through. A lot of the talent in those clubs is essentially low-hanging fruit. It's there for the taking.
There's lots of bargains going there, you know.
Absolutely. A lot of French clubs that are looking to English clubs to take something out of their wage bill, maybe drop 10, 15 million pounds. It'd be very, very helpful for some of those clubs. Unfortunate situation, but other football clubs are always going to take advantage of that kind of scenario. In terms of sort of anything high profile, it would surprise me. And I'm also, I'm not sure where they would do that kind of business. I mean, where in their first 11 they would do it. Diogo Jota has been an excellent signing. I know he had a little bit of an injury. Well, I mean, we still haven't, we've barely seen Thiago, and we don't need to wait. We know he's a brilliant player. Defence, I still think over time, Virgil van Dijk is going to need a partner, a proper partner, someone that... someone that can be relied on physically. I think Joe Gomez is an excellent footballer, but he's fragile. John Matip again has suffered injury, so I don't know. I just don't think that January. I don't think that January is the right market for them to sign anything other than a prospect, for someone that's gonna, a 22, 23 year old who's gonna need a couple of years to develop. Do Liverpool need that kind of player at the moment? Need is the wrong word. They could do with it, and it would be nice, but. I don't see them improving their side via that route. So for me, it's a no, Mike.
Do you know what? If I could just jump in there, you know what? I totally agree with Seb on that. And all logic tells us that basically, it should be a prospect. But the one thing is, I just think that with Liverpool is that suddenly from time to time, as it did look for a few clubs, in the end it didn't happen, that a bizarre one could come from left field, like a Jerome Boateng, and suddenly be available, offered on loan.
That's true.
And listen, I'm not saying that, that's just a name plucked out of the air. I'm not saying that Boateng's going to Liverpool or anything like that. But sometimes you'll find that defender who's not playing, who's come out of left field, who's got a good pedigree, who just wants a six-month loan, particularly with the Euros this summer. And I just think that that has got to be an answer, because otherwise, I just think it's going to be a long, hard test for Liverpool, because I think Liverpool should win the Premier League title, in my view. But I just think defensively, that it's such a worry. It's such an issue for Liverpool. And they'll go on conceding goals and dropping silly points simply because they're clearly without their best two centre-halves in Van Dijk and Gomez.
You know what's really interesting, guys, is like, obviously, most of the major clubs around Europe would have expected fans to be back by now. I mean, I know nobody would have put in a hard budget for this kind of thing, for a situation which is so fluid. But a lot of clubs would have thought, right, Christmas 2020, you know, maybe not full house, but we'll have maybe 25, 30,000 back. You'd wonder whether in January there's going to be quite a lot of agents or intermediaries who've been tasked with finding a way of alleviating wage budget issues. So you're going to get players who ordinarily would never be available, who, you know, for 6 months, a year, you know, someone's been given the instruction, right, we need that 150 grand a week off our wage bill for a little bit of time just to ease the pressure. So that kind of deal, it might not even just be for Liverpool, even clubs sort of further down the food chain, those kind of players are going to be available probably at a lesser cost than usual.
Yeah, well, I suppose it all does boil down to the old issue of recruitment, doesn't it? And I suppose in that sense, John, Leicester are exemplars, aren't they? They're third, very softly approach. Their recruitment's been terrific. You know, Fofana's probably the latest one. They've got the reliables, Vardy, Albrighton, Kasper Schmeichel had his 500th game at the weekend. Where are we with their challenge, do you think?
It was interesting. Before the game, I was at Stamford Bridge yesterday, and like a lot of clubs, they're sort of struggling really to accommodate all the press, and so to random sort of spread out across the ground. And a few of us journalists were sort of grouped around the socially distanced, of course, watching a TV screen behind the stand, watching the end of Newcastle Leicester. And they were just, saw Tielemans score that goal. And I just sort of said, Tielemans, what a player he is. What a snip. And someone did point out that, well, it was about 40 million quid, which I'd kind of forgotten about. But actually, that Leicester, they're just, their business is sensational, their recruitment. You know, there's Sil Chilwell for £50 million, which I have to say I thought was actually cheaper than what they might normally get. But actually, it's a transfer window in the summer during a pandemic, and they've gone and got themselves a bit of an upgrade, they would argue anyway, you know, in replacement, and pocketed the cash. I mean, they just do brilliant business. While Arsenal kind of got Saliba from France, they've gone and got Fofana. Alvin Reddy, straight in, Bosch is playing fantastic, and Johnny Evans, what a signing. He signed a new contract, by the way. And when they signed him, everyone said, oh, he's finished, you know, sort of thing, basically. It's, you know, shame they didn't get him a few years earlier. They just signed him to a new contract. He's been that good. I mean, it's just sensational. The one area where I think Leicester is still an issue is obviously the striker. Jamie Vardy, if Jamie Vardy is absent, missing for a few games, not just the odd one here or there, that's an issue for Leicester. But if Leicester keep on carrying on like this and Jamie Vardy carries on doing what he does brilliantly in amongst the team structure, then I think that Leicester are definitely pushing for top four this season. I think it would be hard to see them win the title, but I do think that they can finish top four, which again is progression on last season. And I think they play some super stuff. I just think what a great time to be a Leicester fan right now. I just think that Brendan Rodgers, superb coach, rebuilding his reputation, if it needed, in English football. I'm not sure that it did really, but doing really good things at Leicester. I think Leicester are on the up and up, and they are. When we saw sort of a ground, albeit a virtual tour of their new training ground, I mean, that is a club seriously going places right now, and they've got players and a manager at the helm who's taking them there, basically.
Yeah. Okay, I suppose it's now time for a hospital pass. Seb, Tottenham.
Oh, no. Okay.
we talk about goal scorers in the context of Leicester there. Well, you know, Heung-min Son, 100 goals for the club. I think it's 22 goals between him and Harry Kane this season. Give me a sort of quantify that partnership with Harry Kane. Is it one of the best in the world, if not the best?
Oh, at the moment, certainly. As an isolated dynamic, just as a pure duo, without question, because you'd really struggle to find a you know, two players who complement each other in quite the same way or who have the same kind of understanding. If you look at that second goal against Leeds, you know, that's it in a nutshell, Mike. You see the timing, you see the vision, you see the anticipation. That's like one of those combinations that we used to celebrate 20, 30 years ago. We used to talk about like I know it's a bit trite, but the kind of the Sheringham-Shearer dynamic, you know, the way that players would read each other's movement, you know, Sutton-Shearer, that's another one. I think what's interesting is what confuses the issue is it's not a traditional combination. So you wouldn't say that Son Heung-min is a number nine, nor is really Harry Kane. They're both kind of just, in inverted commas, attacking players, you know, forwards in the kind of the modern broad sense. And as a result, they encompass a far broader range of the pitch as well. So you see Son's effect is pretty much down the entire left side of the field, often from 60, 70 yards away from goal. Kane has become very similar. It's not unusual to see him receiving passes in his own half anymore in the centre circle. And so if you add all of that up, so if you add the damage they're able to do in the opposition penalty area with the way that they're able to begin moves in a counter-attacking system and also the manner in which they complement what their head coach is currently trying to do, I mean, it's a match made in heaven. It ticks all the boxes for everybody involved, which is not the same thing as saying that Spurs are, that the rest of the Spurs side live up to that. But it's brilliant. And actually, one thing I'll say about Son Heung-min is when he first turned up at Spurs, I didn't think he had a long-term future in English football. He was obviously a very gifted player, but in terms of his effect, he would play in pulses. Every couple of weeks, he'd have a good game or he'd do something good, and then he'd go missing. But actually, over time, he has conditioned himself properly. He's developed a proper understanding of his defensive responsibilities, and he's shown a real determination to be a success at that club, and that's hugely admirable. He has become a genuinely world-class player, and it actually baffles me that it's a little bit of a strange time at the moment, but maybe a couple of years ago that clubs like Real Madrid and Barcelona didn't pay any attention to him. It speaks to something slightly strange in the game, I think, but in terms of a dynamic attacking player, you do very well to find anyone better than that.
Mm. Yeah, Seb mentioned the head coach, John. Should we be resigned to periodic questioning of Mourinho's approach? Because he's not going to change, is he?
No. I think Seb mentioned the head coach without almost naming him, really. This is distaste coming there. But
he who must not be named.
don't you two put words in my mouth. I'm not having that day on social media. That's not fair at all.
It's this age-old thing, isn't it? You know, which always fascinates me as someone looking in that basically, you know, do you trade off a season watching pragmatic football for success or kind of do you want your classic free-flowing entertaining football instead? And that's the dilemma, isn't it, for Spurs fans? And I think they flirted with the pragmatic, we'll take it for a year if it brings us success, up until maybe the Liverpool game. And then Liverpool happened, and they played really well in that game, and were unlucky to lose, just as Jose said, obviously. And I just think that then why not go for the juggler against Wolves? That's the baffling one. Go and win the game, and that's the difficult one to take. And I just think that Mourinho, I think, and Spurs will just fall short of a title challenge. I think they can get into the top four. And I think then they'll be looking at a domestic cup. You know, it's the semi-final this week. And I think that maybe that sort of kind of pushes them on. But we know that sort of fans of certain clubs want football to match their own philosophy and their trophies. And I actually think that shouldn't be ridiculed. That should be applauded, really. I think that goes for Tottenham or Newcastle or whichever sort of reach of the table. I think the fact that football fans want decent football to watch, then, and I just think at various points, Mourinho has flirted with it. I think that's the thing. I think that maybe West Ham was a bit of a turning point when they drew 3-3, let a three-goal lead slip, but I just think that the Mourinho that we know, love, hate, tolerate filling your gap basically is, you know, is alive and well and still does things the way that he wants to. And I'm not sure that necessarily it fits with the long-term philosophy at Tottenham, but I do think it will bring them silverware. I really do. Whether it's this season or next, I think that basically he'll deliver some trophies.
What about Arsenal, Seb? Now, you might not be able to win things with kids, but you can certainly rescue a season by the look of it. Emile Smith-Rowe, who, you know, speaking to scouts, were all over him for the last couple of years. Bukayo Saka, sort of same background, same wavelength. You've got Kieran Tierney, who looks to be a leader in the making, at least. There's very, very sudden, you know, it's a weird season, isn't it? So many mood swings. Arsenal feel good about themselves now, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's an attitude more than anything else. Like Smith Rowe and Saka, they're great players. I mean, it feels like we've been waiting for Smith Rowe to have this moment for quite a while now. But he's certainly, I mean, he looks a very talented player. Looks like it's very much like a Gareth Southgate player, by the way, which is interesting too. But the thing at Arsenal, like, I feel like it reminds me of the early days actually under Pochettino at Spurs. Arsenal fans might not like that, but that recovery hinged on a group of players who weren't perfect, who were learning as they went, but who restored something, an unquantifiable something, to the way people felt about just watching the team. Not about the results and the winning and the losing and the place in the league table, but the experience of actually going to the stadium, not so much at the moment, but the experience of watching the side. And, you know, the texture of the team almost. And so I'm less interested in what Arsenal can do to Sam Allardyce's West Brom, because, well, whatever, really. But in terms of how everything feels, like, if it's these players have helped to vanquish some of the suspicion that resided in different parts of that team. Like, because I think that for a long time, some of those Arsenal players have become really, really good at making faces and, you know, fronting up in inverted commas, whatever that actually means, you know, and acting in the way that they think they should because of the way it plays the cameras. And all of a sudden, that's starting to be replaced with a little bit more substance. And that's really important. Before anything else happens, before you start worrying about qualifying for stuff or winning trophies or, you know, winning derbies, any of that, it's how players behave when they wear the shirt. And Arsenal seem to start to be almost on the verge of getting that bit right. And that's, you know, that's very much the first step.
It's probably unfair to link into Mesut Ozil after this, John, but I will.
That's the hospital pass. That's the hospital pass.
Do you think there's going to be any chance of a resolution this month?
No. No. I think the only resolution that will be reached is Mesut Ozil, who puts his foot down and says, I'm staying. Listen, I think the issue for this is, and sort of maybe just to sort of clarify on this, that Arsenal, what 3.5 years ago, were desperate to re-sign the player. In that contract, we're so worried about him leaving, you know, stacked it up with bonus payments right until the end, loyalty payments, so to ensure that he wouldn't leave, so that basically it was incentivized for him to see out the contract. The irony of that, obviously, is what, you know, 2 years later into that deal, and they're trying to get rid. Now, it would be pretty unprecedented for a club to pay up the bonuses in full, but they'd have to pay up the contract in full, frankly, and clubs just don't, you know, they'll pay the kind of reach an agreement, but they won't pay off a bonus. Although I have to say, this is a unique set of circumstances whereby they can't even play the player if they're not selecting him in the Premier League and Europa League squads. And they're not going to. It's as simple as that. Come the end of the window, they won't. And I just think, what a terrible end to Ozil's time at Arsenal. It's at times he was brilliantly breathtaking and fantastic, and at times incredibly frustrating. But they did still sign one of the best players in the world at his time. He's won the World Cup during that time, and frankly, he's signed a player at his peak from Real Madrid. And I think we'll look back upon his time at Arsenal with greater affection than we do now, simply because it's petered out so badly. And I still think questions should be asked as to how on earth, at a time when we've been questioning Arsenal's midfield creativity, you still can't find a place for him, not in the team, but in a 25-man squad. I think that's utterly bizarre. Almost as bizarre as his kind of pointless tweets and postings on social media after Arsenal games. I mean, it's just, you know, it's embarrassing, it's comical, and it's this very, very sorry way to see out the end of Mesut Ozil. But they're going in a different direction. And as Seb mentioned, those kids are really refreshing. There's nothing like a new injection of hope for a team and a squad, like a sudden influx of young homegrown players. Some of those kids are absolutely terrific, aren't they? So exciting to watch.
Yeah, they certainly are. They certainly overwhelmed West Brom, as did Leeds. Do you think the Hawthorns is where the myth of Big Sam will be exposed, Seb?
I don't know yet. I mean, I think in the early days of Allardyce, the way he works tends to involve swamping players with video analysis and coaching points, which sometimes can take a little bit of time to... they can take a little bit of time to adjust to. And so if you look back over his record at, you know, whichever club you care to mention, it tends to get a little bit worse first. So let's just put a pin in that and come back to it. I'm a little bit concerned by the nature of some of these defeats. The loss to Leeds was dreadful. Like, you can get a little bit worse, but that's kind of, you know, that tends to involve losing 1-0 at home, not like that. And we've just finished praising Arsenal, and everything we've said is true and fair. But at the same time, that was a pretty abject performance as well. Like, because in the snow, in the cold, and of course, at the highest point in the country, where it's probably, you know, as inhospitable a place as you could play a football match on a snowy day, you would have thought, cliche dictates, that Arsenal should be roughed up a little bit. And yet West Brom didn't put a glove on them. And that was very, very disappointing, because that's the bare minimum. Before you talk about improving defensive standards and, you know, getting to second balls first and all the things that Allardyce is supposed to do well, you want a little bit of heart and fight in a performance. And there was absolutely none in the whole of last week, actually. So I don't know, but I'd be worried, but we'll see.
One of the consequences of Leeds winning at the Hawthorns, basically, and I want to try and bring this together now, is the whole debate about the use of social media or the abuse of social media. I thought the tweet by Leeds, which led to the abuse of Karen Carney, was unforgivable. Are we in danger, John, of almost overhyping the game so much now where it becomes really counterproductive?
Probably, yes. I mean, I do, you know, I do think there's a debate here to be had. I think that Karen Carney is such a good pundit and really well researched. And whether it's on TV or radio, I think she comes across really well and is one of my favourite, should we say, new voices sort of in the business, if you like, because she's got something to say, an input, and sometimes comments with an edge, basically. And I actually think that's great. I think that's really good to have sort of strong opinions. But then equally, my only thought on the Leeds thing, and I know this, you know, won't go down well with everyone concerned, is that basically if she's had something strong to say about Leeds, then I do think Leeds have probably got a right to reply. And in the age of social media, where it's jokey and funny, then I actually think that basically what Leeds did, I think, was okay. Where I thought it was incredibly wrong was that the sort of people jumping on that, whether that be Leeds fans or neutrals or whoever, or sexist, misogynist, outdated people, were jumping on that and making shocking comments. But should Leeds have been aware that that would definitely happen? Well, I don't know that they were sort of saying, you know, it's an open invitation to go and abuse.
But surely, John, the nature of social media, you know, that showed at best a basic misunderstanding of the power, which can be positive, but it also can be negative, of social media. I thought it was extraordinary that the owner came out and actually backed the social media team who did that, because, you know, it was obvious to anyone who has any experience of social media, and we all have, we've all been abused ourselves. I just cannot see how that was even thought about.
Well, Look, I think that what, you know, I think her opinions are really, really good and strong. Mm. And then basically, what do we expect? You know, if a Leeds player or the manager had been asked about it, which often happens, are we then saying that basically then that isn't fair game then to report that or tweet that? And I think that often happens. But the difference, obviously, I understand it's coming from a Leeds, you know, the official Leeds account. But I do still think that aren't they entitled to reply? And I personally thought where it's horrendously wrong was people seeing it as an open invitation to abuse and jump on it. Now, personally, I think that highlights everything that's wrong with social media. So in no way am I defending the kind of abuse then that she got, because I think, as I say, I think she's a great pundit, really interesting. But that for me is something we've got to tackle with social media. And I think that part of the issue here is that we've seen more racist abuse aimed at the Bournemouth player, the Junior Stanislaus, this weekend. And what we're doing about it, basically. It feels like we're not doing very much. I mean, as you mentioned, you know, I've been abused. We've all been abused, and frankly, it almost feels like, oh well, I've been abused, so what? And like no one does anything about it. And I just think that for me is the bigger issue, because I feel as if social media companies had done something about it and taken action, then I don't think that people jump on that tweet and reply to it in the way that they did, and therefore you can have a bit of fun, you can have a reply without it getting abusive. And yet what it turned out to be was anything but fun, anything but. And I think that is the disgusting nature of it. And I just think it comes down to, for me, highlights again the faults with social media rather than me thinking it was the issue with the Leeds tweet. I think the abuse suffered is totally unacceptable, but for years we've let it go by with no one showing any appetite to tackle it.
And that's the real central point, and you're right to bring that up, John. Are we in danger, do you think, Seb, of almost a normalisation of this sort of abuse, and especially racial abuse? You know, it's almost a daily, weekly occurrence these days, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Normalization is probably the right word there, Mike, unfortunately, because I wouldn't claim to be an expert, and I don't know what it is to obviously receive racist abuse, misogynist abuse, homophobic abuse. I don't have an experience of that. What I will say is that there seems to be this increasing, I don't even know how to describe it. It's just when something happens in football now, this is a place that people feel able to go. You know, before, if you wrote about football, if you spoke about football, if you described it, you had an opinion on it, it was, for whatever reason, people felt entitled to abuse you, whoever you were. And that's just, you know, Crossy's obviously felt the Twitter pitchfork many times. You know, anytime you report something that people don't like, or you comment on a game which a team has lost, and you expose yourself to the ludicrous sensitivity of a lot of people. This new thing now is really dispiriting, because it feels like anything that happens in the game is now, for some people, the green light to go and racially abuse somebody. Remember Stephen Bergwijn missing a chance at Anfield a couple of weeks ago, and he had to limit his social media accounts because people have been racially abusing him. That is ridiculous. And yet, it doesn't surprise me in the slightest. And that is a terrible thing. To both be shocked by something and to be completely unsurprised by the way people are behaving, that describes something that is really malignant. And Crossy's right. There is not even close to being enough recourse for these people, because it's as if there's nothing to, I don't know, people just behave in this unguarded way. And I don't want to hear anybody say that it's got anything to do with the pandemic, because it hasn't, because it predates that by a long, long time. And it's so dispiriting. It makes me, you know what, it makes me hate the game a little bit. that it's become a theatre for people to behave like that, that somehow because your team didn't get the win that you wanted, or, you know, they didn't score, you know, a player didn't take the chance in exactly the right way, or in this case, a player hit the inside of the post, you know, away from home, that all of a sudden that's now a green light to behave like that. It's dreadful. It makes me hate the game. The game welcomes people like that, and it's an absolute disgrace. No, I see no evidence whatsoever of any kind of reasonable response to that. It's dreadful.
Yeah, it's really sad to hear you speak like that, mate. I know that the issue of social media abuse is bigger than football, and that clubs in the main make positive use of the interactive platforms, charitable ventures, support of things like local food banks. But we really need to challenge unnecessary tribalism. Now, something has to happen. I think all three of us agree on that, because social media is out of control. Thanks in the meantime to John and Seb. And on a happy note, here's to another 300 episodes of the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.